I'm Matt Godbolt.
And I'm Ben Rady.
And this is To's Compliment, a programming podcast.
Hey, Matt.
Hey, Ben.
Hey, I got an idea for a topic.
Hang on. I'm the one who says, hey, Ben, first. This is confusing me.
We're flipping the script today.
All right. And I don't even know what this topic is. What's the topic?
It's a really general topic. I want to talk about video games.
What's not to like about video games?
I know. This is the thing. So I want to talk about the games that we play. I want to talk about how these games are made. I want to talk about the evolution of video games from, like, the days when, like, one person could build a video game to now where it's, like, a, you know, multi-million dollar movie production type thing.
There are still games that one person produces.
Yes.
Yeah,
and how so it's sort of been reborn in other forms, you know, like Steam and mobile games and all these other things that sort of like have recreated that world where it's like one person can make a game. So I want to talk about all of those things.
I love this topic. Let's do it.
So where do you want to start?
Well, what even are a video game?
What even are a video game? Well, that's, yeah, what is...
What are we talking about? Are we going to talk about like console-based stuff? Are we going to talk about, you know, handheld? Are we going to talk about all the above? Or what are you thinking specifically? Are you
thinking it's the whole world. It's the whole world of video games. So So let's talk about I'm going to ask you a question.
Okay.
Because you just made an assertion that says an individual person can make a video game, right? And that's true. Can an individual person make a console game? Is that a reasonable thing to expect that anyone could do?
I think so still. I mean, the example that immediately springs to mind is Stardew Valley, which is on Steam and is on consoles and is on all the things, as far as I can tell. And my understanding is that one person, Concerned Ape, made that game as a kind of like, I just wanted to make a game, and then eventually was like, hey, this game's pretty good. His girlfriend's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, oh, I'm just, you know, enjoying doing some coding. It's like, oh, but I made a video game. And as far as I'm aware, and now this is huge speculation, he did the art and the sound and the game and everything and then put it together. And I think, so you can do that. But I also don't know if it was a success on Steam first and then he got like the dev kits and things that would allow you to port it to that or anything. So I don't know if someone could sit down and make a video game on a console without voiding the warranty on the current console in the first place and installing all sorts of open source development tools, because they don't generally let you do that.
That's a
thing. Whereas the accessibility...
That is still a path, though, right? Like, if your dream was to, you know, I want to make an Xbox game, right? Xbox might be a little easier to do this with, but... you could get there by first making a game and publishing it on Steam and then building and a market for
it. An engine that is somewhat portable anyway. Now, I don't know what Stardew Valley is written in, but in the back of my mind when I'm playing it and it sort of does one of those little glitches where it takes a little while suddenly and you're walking along otherwise smoothly and it's like, oh, and then carries on again. In my mind, I'm thinking, I wonder if this is some kind of garbage collected runtime thing going on. Is this mono? Is this running C-sharp?
I mean,
something like that. And is that why it's been able to be ported reasonably easily? I don't know. I know nothing about it, and I'm sure we could easily Google it. But let's talk more generally about things. But you know, there are engines that are available. There's the Unreal Engine. There is the Unity, thank you. Yeah. Good grief. I was only talking with somebody about it earlier today. There's Unity and a whole bunch of things like that that you can get, and there are commercial licenses, obviously, but there's also, I mean, you sign up for Unreal Engine and they give you access to it, so you can just... So it is more accessible than it's ever been to get like a world-class engine to write your game on, and then maybe be able to port it from platform to platform more straightforwardly. But I don't know how... whether that's really an exception. You know, is Stardew Valley by its very nature and from the kind of game that you could reasonably do this? Because even like the Pokemons of this world that, you know, have a similar flavor, it's just a top-down thing. It's only a few sprites, really. Obviously, there's millions of permutations and combinations of Pokemon, but just ignoring that. But that kind of genre, top-down, scrolly, walk-aroundy thing. Even 2 decades ago, that would have been a team of 5 people.
Yeah.
You know, maybe one programmer, an artist, musician type person who's on part time. Mm-hmm. Maybe, you know, so three, maybe four for a tools person or whatever. So, you know, you could easily see how it could be a multi-person game even back then. So, yeah, I don't know. I think it's exceptional for an individual to make a fully featured game. And but I love the idea that people can.
Yeah.
You know, my complaint about the games industry when I left it was that nobody was taking any risks anymore.
Right.
All of the publishers, it was so expensive to make a video game, and I can't really blame them. They wanted a surefire hit, so it would be franchise after franchise. It would be movie game. Mm-hmm. You know, it would be another SWAT game.
Right.
It would be another, you know, a sequel to an already existing game, but not like a new IP or new idea or new out there idea. And I think probably when Nintendo came, they've always sort of danced to the tune of their own drum to an extent. When they came along with the Switch and kind of blew everyone out the order of the world with all these really random, weird, different games, they only did it because they knew that they could sell Mario to people like me.
right.
So as well as your weird Wii Sports thing, it's like, I'm going to be buying that no matter what, because it will have the new Zelda game on it and it will have the new Mario game on it. Yes. So there is
They're still using Zelda to pay the bills and then using that money to do all the cool experimental stuff that they want to
try. Yeah, exactly. Right. But the EAs of this world that are churning out sports game after sports game or whatever, and the, you know, the other places that have good franchises, it's not that much of an incentive to experiment because it's so expensive if you get it wrong. But if you're one person in a bedroom somewhere,
right,
and you're investing your life, then sure, go for it. So
give it a try. I feel like there's something with that, with the sort of desire by game, you know, publishers to do version 2, version 3, version 4. I mean, how many Civilizations are there right now? Like 85, 86, something like that.
At least that.
And I love Civilization. It's a great game, but it's like, you guys have got a cash cow and you're just milking it, right? But I feel like the sort of realization of that in the early days was just, you just make more versions of the game, and the same effect underlies it, but I think the sort of more modern version of that is the like in-game purchases and
DLCs.
Cosmetics and DLCs, where it's like you when you make a game, if it's, you know, even a remotely decent game, you're going to find some core group of people that really, really, really like it, and they're going to spend absurd amounts of money on it. They're going
to
spend
just to change
10
the color
or 100 times,
or
yes.
Whatever.
They're going to spend way more than what your average or your median, really, player is going to spend, right?
Yeah.
And so you don't, like, one way to do that is to just release version 2, 3, 4, 5 of the game and they'll buy it because they're fanatics. But another way to take advantage of that is to give them things in the existing game, sort of let them, you know, kind of revel in this thing that they love, right?
Yeah. To the extent even that some of those games are given away for free.
Exactly, right?
And all the money comes from the loot chests that you buy or whatever, right?
Yeah, the median revenue per player is zero.
Yeah.
And the average is actually quite good, right? Yeah. Yeah, so
it really has changed. I mean, the fact that you can have DLCs and the fact that you can even patch games after they've come out. I mean, like, who hasn't bought a game close to the day of opening, put it into their console, and it goes, wait a second, we've just got 2.5 terabytes of patches to apply to it before you can play it. And you're sort of explaining to your crying child why they still can't play the game yet.
So I actually had this yesterday with I'm a huge Diablo player. I love Diablo. It is a mindless game. It's like mostly mindless. There's like a little bit of, like, you know, planning strategy stuff to it, but it is mostly just a click on things and watch, you know, pretty pictures and things be destroyed kind of game. And it's like a guilty pleasure of mine, but I've been playing it ever since I was like a teenager, essentially, like in my early 20s. Diablo 4 is coming out this summer, and there is a beta this weekend, a closed beta. So if you pre-order the game, you can play it this weekend for a few days, And this is, you know, it's I actually love the way that they're doing this. So it's sort of like there's the closed beta this weekend if you pre-order it, which is clearly the like, all right, this is our first world test. And then there is an open beta next weekend where you don't even have to have paid for the game, which is clearly their load test.
Right.
It's like, we make no guarantees that any of this is going to work. In fact, we might even break some things on purpose just to see how our failover mechanisms work. But I pre-ordered this, and I also got a copy of it for my son because his birthday is next week, and I thought it'd be cool if we could play together this weekend, right? Pre-order the game. It sends him a gift, like, you know, confirmation link. He clicks the confirmation link, null pointer exception.
No!
And he's like in a panic. Like, I came home from work yesterday, and he's like in a panic of like, ah, thank you for the game, but I can't get it to work, and it's a thing, it's, what am I going to do? And it's like, you know, the beta is like this weekend, right? It's like basically.
Like,
so it's sort of like, oh my God, what are we going to do? And it's like, yep, that is how these things are, right? You put the disc in there, and it's like, you know, it wasn't really baked when they shipped this, right? Like,
yeah,
it wasn't,
right.
It wasn't really done.
That's not how it, yeah, which, you know, to me is interesting, the amount of effort that we used to put into our discs and the care and the terror, actually,
right, yeah,
of being there with the guy in the motorbike leathers from the shipping from the courier company is standing in reception looking at his watch, and you are around the 12 disc CD burner telling people not to jump around because these things were so sensitive to vibration, while the last 12 of the Gold Masters were being made, and then writing on them really carefully, not getting your fingers on them, and then handing them to this person going like, I hope to heaven that's good, because that's it now. There's no comeback from here.
Right, right.
And if I don't know if I've ever told the story, but twice games that I, not that I worked on, but friends of mine at the same company have worked on, have had there's the kind of terrifying glitches that happen that only when you like finally build the disc, ship it, and then people put it into their non-developer consoles and run it for the first time.
Mm,
and uninitialized variables come to light, shall we say, in the hardware.
Wow. Yeah.
Variables that were initialized by the debug console that pops up and says, you know, welcome to Sega Saturn. This is, you know, a 32X. Here's a memory you've got and you can do whatever. But they aren't initialized from a cold start on a machine that doesn't have that operating system like ROM in it. It just boots the disk. And then you get like a dinosaur with his head inside out that looks terrifying to children because you can see all his teeth and eyeballs in the inside of his head. So, yeah. So you don't get that so much anymore, but you get null pointer exception.
You get null pointer exception, right? Yeah. Oh my God. Okay, I have another question. Here's more of a hypothetical scenario for discussion. Let's say you and I were going to found a game company, and let's say that we were going to found this company with a few other people, and we needed to come up with some way to sort of coalesce all of our ideas about games into a cohesive vision for this group. Like, what kind of games do we want to make? How do we even establish a common language about games and make sure that if we're talking to each other about our ideas, that those ideas make sense to the other people that are hearing them? Here's my thought experiment on how you do this. Everyone in the group picks a game, and every other person in the group plays the game that everyone else picked. So if there's five people, we're going to all play five games. And the intent of what the game that you pick is to represent sort of the platonic ideal of the game that you want to make, right? It's like, I would love to make a game like this.
Yeah.
What game do you pick?
Oh, man. So the nearest thing to the kind of vision that I have... Oh, you see, can I pick two? No, I'm not allowed to pick two. Because what I would love to make is kind of a hybrid between two games, and I'd love to sort of... So let me explain to you my knee-jerk reaction about the game that is modern and would most clearly represent the aesthetic and the vibe that I would want out of a game, and in fact the mechanics to some extent, and just everything, and that would be Breath of the Wild, Zelda Breath of the Wild, right? It's just an accomplished, beautiful, beautiful game. It's staggering how amazing the graphics are, given that it's running on just a Switch that is, you know, pretty pedestrian, even when it was first made. You know, Nintendo have never made any bones about putting the most whiz-bang features in their rendering system, or, you know, they make money on their consoles, which nobody else does, right? Everyone else sells their consoles at a loss so that they can get them in your house, right, and they make money on the games. Nintendo just make money on everything they do with you, and mugs like me that will buy every incarnation of every Mario, Zelda, and everything game, even though I've already got it, right? But anyway, so the aesthetic of that, the way that it, the pacing of it and everything is beautiful, and I love it. And the fact that it's open world, that is what I like. I like the idea of there is a plot if I want it, and if there's not, I can happily wander around and just hit trees and stare at the things, the beautiful sunsets that happen, and just hang out in a game that's just like, I'd like to live here if it wasn't for the nasty monsters, right? You know, but I can avoid them largely. It feels so that is my kind of game. I'm much more of a casual gamer than I ever used to be. And so the idea of a game that you can pick up and put down and give or take, you know, a big screen that can show you, here's what you're supposed to be doing. I can pretty much go, I don't care. I'm going to, what's that over there? Oh, hang on a second. Those three things look like, and then find a Korok or whatever, you know, that kind of thing. So that's my ideal. The second part of that is the game Exile from the BBC Micro, which was one of the first open world 2D games. Spaceman flying around in like caves looking for stuff, and I feel that there is morally a way of taking a sort of Metroid-y feel in terms of like spacefaring suited person in a like a hostile environment and marrying it in 3D with something more open worldy like Legend of Zelda. So that's kind of like broadly what I would like to engender upon the team, as it were, and say something that that draws from from the palette of these things is what I want. What would you do then? What would be your choice or choices now, as I've had two?
No, I think I, I mean, so I have thought about this a little bit, and I think for me it's XCOM. I really liked the XCOM world, you know, aliens and you know, sort of proto-military and all of these other things. And I actually, like, it's not even like one of the XCOM games, it's the whole franchise, right? The whole progression from, you know, you're starting out where it's like, oh no, this is the US government and there's these tiny little alien invasions, all the way into the modern incarnations, which is aliens have taken over the world and now you're basically fighting a guerrilla war, right? And everything in between there. And that the whole world, I think, is just really kind of interesting and immersive, and it just sort of locks you in. And I really like tactical games in general. I like the sort of like both the like the squad optimization that you do, where you're sort of like, you know, maximizing resources and building up the, doing research and building the best, you know, equipment that you can get and all the things. And then the actual like tactics of the combat, right? Where you're like, you know, trying to move and, you know, do things efficiently.
Because that's sort of isometric, well, at least it was in my day, isometric turn-based, you know, move your squad around here and then you kind of click, 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 and then you go, and then everyone moves, and then you kind of, the screen scrolls around and you sort of, you get these hints of aliens running across the your field of vision. You know, oh my gosh, oh, I didn't realize there was one hiding behind the bin or whatever. Yeah, that kind of thing,
And part of this is because I'm a huge, like, D&D player, and I like D&D, and those mechanics are literally, like, I mean, the slightly different rule set, of course, but it's like those tactical combat mechanics are exactly what you're doing when you're rolling D20s in Dungeons and Dragons, right? Like, you know, you've got however many actions per turn, and you sort of can do these different things, and you have different equipment that you use. And so XCOM for me sort of blends together, you know, all of those different elements into something that has a, like a very cohesive world, and tells like a just a great story. Like the story really sort of pulls you in,
right?
And part of the thing, and I think that is probably what it is.
And it's the nearest thing to a board game you can play on a computer as well, right?
Yeah.
It's like turn based as it is, you know.
Right. Yes, it's a game that you can play with a baby resting on your shoulder, which I certainly did when my kids were young. It's sort of like it's turn based, so you can just walk away at any time, you know.
Yeah, you don't have to be twitch.
You don't have to be twitchy. You don't have to have the fastest reflexes in the world. You just have to sort of sit.
Don't even have to have two hands for a little bit.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So yeah, so that would probably be mine. But I feel like if you did this, it would be a way for people to sort of like start out with their preconceptions just laid out on the table, right?
Right.
Like, because if you brought a bunch of people together like this, it'd be like, everyone is there for, they've got that thing in their head of, oh, wouldn't it be great if I did this? And they're all going to be different, right?
Yeah, of course.
And then you sort of get all that out, you get it out on the table, and you're like, all right, this is my perfect game. This is my perfect game. This is my perfect game. And you're going to see all the differences. And then hopefully you like start to triangulate a little bit. You sort of find like a middle point. Or you be like, look, I don't want to make like the Homer car here and make a game that is just a mix of all these five things, because that's going to be terrible. But I really like your idea, so I'm gonna give up my dream a little bit because I like your dream too, and we're gonna just go in that direction because I think that's better, right?
No, it's an interesting thought experiment. Yeah. Definitely, if the games industry wasn't quite so miserable,
right? Yeah, the only problem is we would actually have to make and publish a video game, which sounds terrible.
Yeah, sounds awful, right? But maybe when we retire from our day jobs, we can sit down and have like cozy afternoon coffee chats where we hypothetically come up with stuff before it becomes too difficult. We have to get like a team of 50 people to do the artwork for it and all that kind of stuff, which is of course the problem, right? You know, it's like any modern game, again, Stardew Valley and similar things and the little indie shops notwithstanding, requires a huge amount of effort. Here's an example, actually, another one that again, theoretically would be straightforward. So one of my favorite games growing up was a game called Wonder Boy 3, The Dragon's Trap, which was a Sega Master System, which never really made it over in the States, a game. But it was a sort of contemporary of the NES, the original 8-bit. It was Sega's equivalent of that. And if you've known the Wonder Boy games, if you've ever seen them, like the coin-op game, it's just a sideways scroller jumpy thing. And it's all Twitch-based, and you're kind of like getting on a skateboard or whatever. Wonder Boy 3 was not like that. It was like an RPG, but sideways scrolling. So in a way, a little bit more like the second Legend of Zelda, which went for a sideways scrolling RPG. It was much more like that. So, and you know, it was still platformy in feel, but it was a great game. I really enjoyed it. And it's one of the reasons why I ended up writing an emulator for the Master System so that I could play it and complete it again on my Archimedes. And then it's why I wrote another version of the emulator so I could play it and complete it in my web browser. So I completed it three times, one on the original and then two on two emulators I wrote myself.
I love that by complete it, you mean make an emulator for it and then complete
it. And then complete it. Yeah, that's right. I mean,
that's an achievement that most people don't get in the video game achievements world. I'm going to tell you right now.
That's right. Yeah, that achievement unlock is like, yeah, you beat it again. But I've beaten it a fourth time now because a professional remake by Lizard Cube, a relatively small company, was made of it. And the really cool thing about it is that they kept the original emulator effectively running the original game, which they had to modify quite heavily to make it work. But at any time you could tap a button and the game would flick back into retro graphics and you could see, oh my gosh, this is how it used to be. But the graphics were absolutely beautiful. They had artists doing these wonderful cartoon style animations that were gorgeous. And then they had a full, I've had the music stuck in my head ever since, but even like today I was humming it. They redid all of the music with a full like orchestra. It was a small orchestra of, you know, a half dozen. And so you're thinking like even something where you had effectively the code to start with and the artwork to start with took a small team of people to make it as polished and beautiful as it is. But it's still possible. It's still plausible, right? So maybe a group of us, the problem is anyone we know doesn't know how to draw.
I know.
Or maybe some people can do music.
I have a kid that knows how to draw. But that's
helpful. That's a whole other thing. But it's a real skill to be able to generate the assets for modern video games and the way that they're put together and the way that you know, economies of scale have to be done, and like, well, this is how we conform. Everyone does the same thing the same way, and then our textures will map up at the edges, match up at the edges. This is the one and only skeleton of the human-like character, and it's got basically the superset of every kind of animatable part of a mannequin you might ever want, and then we animate things in terms of that, and then you can attach any of your T-pose models to this, and then they will animate in the same way, so we don't have to like animate every single monster individually or whatever for the base start point. So there's a ton of stuff like that, and I mean, obviously it's been in two decades really since I've been fully involved in this kind of stuff, but I wonder how much we would have to relearn ourselves. I tell you, we'd have great tests.
That is actually an area, because we talked about this before. Our testing is a skill. Learning how to test in different languages has different skills. Learning how to test different aspects of different programs in different languages is different skills. Testing a web app in Python is different than testing like a data processing pipeline in Python is different than, you know, all of these things. I've never had the opportunity to try to take my testing skills and apply them to video games. I did a little bit that's sort of adjacent to it when, like, my first, you know, few years out of school, the company that I worked for did a lot of data visualization. Most of that was 2D. And I think I maybe even told you once about the thing that I built that did the sort of vectorization of rasterized 2D graphics as a way to test them, right? And that was more of an integration style test, but it was like...
But it's a test nonetheless, yeah.
Right? Like, we're just going to take these 2D graphics and re-vectorize them and then compare them to the original vectors with some epsilon and make sure that they're correct, right?
Yeah.
But like outside of that, I've never really had a chance to flex those muscles.
So maybe no. That could be an interesting... So I can't... You weren't in my presentation at work on Thursday, were you?
I know. I never see them because I have the lunch on Thursday.
I know, but like literally, I was talking about my experiences developing SWAT Global Strike Team, which one of the slides is it started out as an XCOM-like game, funnily enough.
Right, there you go.
Called Cleaners with a K.
Oh yeah,
you remember? Yeah, seen this. You've seen the presentation before, but I wondered if this was brought top of mind to you because of that presentation. But one of the slides that I was just reminded of is the line count. So I still have a some amount of the code around, and I was able to like do some primitive statistics on it, like 130,000 lines of code, if I remember right, and a few thousand lines of I think it was 200 lines of x86 assembly, about 6,000 lines of shaders, which was Xbox, 7,000 lines of PlayStation 2 assembly code, which is to say far too much, but it was a miserable processor. Anyway, and then at the bottom, the funny thing was, and 1,300 lines of tests. Like the whole thing is like 1%. I think I know that all those tests were for the math library. Which was like, well, this is foundational, and frankly, it's easy to test.
Yeah,
and more importantly, we could test it on the x86 host because there wasn't too much that was special case, at least for the sort of general. And then obviously you start doing like the intrinsics to say, all right, we're going to use this crazy multiply that's only on this process or whatever. But then that was essentially untested because there wasn't an easy way back then to get the feedback from the console, as it would have to be back to the CI system. Not that we had a CI system. Am I kidding? But it would be really interesting to see whether the world has moved on. I sincerely hope it has. But if it hasn't, to see your take on it would be fascinating.
I would be very interested in doing something like that. I feel like the sort of meta answer there is, as long as you go into it with the philosophy of like we are going to have a way to validate all these things that we want to be confident that our system does, we're going to use unit tests where we can, but we're going to expand our mind beyond that and look at the broader goal, which is just be confident that it works.
How do you
create intersubjective confidence that it works? How do you create confidence that I can create and you can share?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You don't have to read through every line of my code to be confident that it works. You can look at the test, you can look at the tool that I use, or whatever it is you can share in the confidence that I created. Right?
That it's going to work, yeah.
Yeah. And so if you think of it in those broader terms, I'm sure that you could find a way to get there. And
right.
It might not look like a suite of unit tests, or a complete suite anyway, but it would be something.
And I think more to the point, nowadays, a lot more of the code would be written in a language or languages that have decent implementations on multiple machine. So you're testing the logic at that point.
Right.
Which actually, this is a complete non sequitur, and this is going to be the weirdest episode ever. But I was discussing with some hardware folks last night. We were in the pub, and I was chatting with them, and I was talking about people who do ASIC design and make ASICs for a living, right? So this is actual silicon chips that get made. And they were saying how even if they are making a new chip, using old code. So, like, mm-hmm. you know, maybe they've got the process has changed. It's no longer 130 nanometer process. They're saying, hey, we're going to target an 80 nanometer process. And so there's different tooling from the vendor that makes the fab, whatever. But effectively, we're going to keep the same code, right? Mm-hmm. It's just the same chip, but we can shrink it down and reduce the power because of the process. And they said, we just don't want to touch the code at all. And I was like, but surely you want to like fix things, tweak it around. Like, no, we look at it and we go, this code has passed the test. And then it's an exhaustive right. set of tests. You can imagine, right? If this is, you're going to spend millions of dollars to make the masks and stuff. It's like $100,000 per layer of a mask, which is like mm-hmm. insane. So they want to not touch the code, because obviously humans write the code and humans are fallible. But the argument I said to them is like, well, but the thing is, that code is not really representative of what actually goes onto the silicon, right? You yeah. take that and then you turn it into a cell library of little off-the-shelf Lego bricks that are then put together by a computer program that puts them together in theory in the same, so it has the same logical output of the code that you created. That's then placed and rooted onto a silicon wafer, and then you build up these mask layers, and then at some point you actually have to run all this kind of like physics-based simulations of, has this particular layout got pathological capacitance problems, crosstalk, do you have to worry about, you know, cosmic rays hitting this particular mm-hmm. bit and knocking things out seriously, mm-hmm. right, at the lower yeah, end no, of this stuff, right? How do you build in that resilience? And you're like, so why is it that you don't, you know, that bit's fine, apparently. You know, all those eight layers of other things where people are like fitting and placing and routing. Is it because that's mostly automated? Although he was describing to me that some of it is not. But, you know, I would imagine that, like, if you've got like seven things, all of which can go horribly wrong because of things that are don't work. Adding one more and actually changing the functionality seems like that's an easy bit, because I can reason about that. And what it made me think was is that, like, it's easy to test that part easier, because at that point you're running a simulation that is like almost like having compiling the C code, in my case, for my target, for my host computer, and saying, well, okay, I can test the functionality of my math library because I can build it for x86 and I can run mathtest.exe on my computer, which is essentially what we were doing. But if I had to target it with a different compiler and a different architecture and then squirt it down a cable to a different computer and run it on that different computer, I'm like, how many other things, potentials are there for things to go wrong in that? Right. So I don't understand why that was like, well, why the tests were, you know, it just feels like a similar thing. It's not like you test what you can, mm-hmm. but sometimes and I'm guilty of this, you know, you test the things that are easy to test and then you kind of go, oh, but this bit's a bit difficult to test, so I'm going to leave it alone. You're like, well, that's where the problems are going to be. I mean, first of all, because you're not looking for them, and secondly, because it's probably complicated, and that means that it's going to have mistakes.
You don't have a test for people jumping near the CD burner while you're burning the golden disk.
Nice. Yes.
Yeah. No, that's true, man. That's true. It's hard. You gotta be real creative when you're trying.
And I suppose to your point, if you go into it with a mindset of not unit tests or integration tests or whatever, but like the mindset is, whatever we make, I want to have the highest confidence, and as you say, intersubjectively, mm-hmm. that this is going to work. And that may mean, and I've seen actually somebody we work with tends to put in their PRs the test plan that they used when mm-hmm. they were working on a change. So obviously there are unit tests in our code as well, but, like, you know, you want to kick the tires a bit yourself, and so mm-hmm. this person will go, this is what I did as well, all the tests pass, I ran this thing and I copied it to a temporary directory, and I had like poked around with them a bit, and then that mm-hmm. made me, and I'm like, cool, because if I really wanted to, I could follow your instructions, do the same thing
exactly. Yeah,
and that's the intersubjectivity that we're talking about.
The intersubjectivity has to come first, the automation comes later, right? Like, all the unit testing stuff started with people who would just make like a little main function and kind of hack some code in there, almost like a REPL, to just be like, oh, I'm going to call this function that I just wrote or this class I just wrote and make sure that it worked. And they're like, oh, well, what if we kept that? And then, oh, what if we just ran that every time? Like, but if you don't start with the sort of intersubjectivity of like, here are the things that I did to gain confidence that this works as I expected it to, anything beyond that doesn't matter, right?
Yeah.
Like, it starts with the intersubjectivity. So
yeah. Well, yeah. You say that. I mean, that was certainly the beginnings of my career was certainly not intersubjective. It'd be like you ran some things, you poked around with it yourself, and you went, oh, it seems good enough to me, and you put it or whatever into
right.
And you're done. Yeah. And then there was no build server to be like, even the build wasn't intersubjective.
Right. Right.
Which I think, you know, I think we've all got behind now. It's like, you know, the whole works on my computer are like, well, that's not good enough anymore.
Right.
We can't just have Barry's computer in the corner.
You know, he can't ship his computer. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, that's why Docker was invented.
That's exactly what. Yeah, I think we've made that point before.
But yeah, it's like, you know, that when you don't have that, when you don't have intersubjectivity, what you're forced to rely on is essentially heroism, right? Like, oh, Matt's a fantastic programmer. He would never make a mistake. Did he write this code? Well, then it must be fine.
Yeah.
Right? It's like appeal. It's like the, you know, the logical fallacy of appeal to authority. Right.
Yeah.
Like there's no way for me to validate that this is right. So I just have to go on faith.
I have to trust
that this hero programmer did it right.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's Well, we've come a long way from a game studio. I just want to point that out, right? We've got back onto old topics, you know, as much as I'd love to talk about.
We did. We did.
Games
I got,
as well.
I got one more.
Let's
time for it. And it's a follow-on to what we were saying before, which is talking about, like, you know, sort of this, like, you know, can a single person make a game? And it's like, ah, you can. It's hard, but you can. Have you seen, maybe this exists already, have you seen a commercially successful, for some definition, commercially successful open source game? Because I could imagine a world where you have a small group of core devs. I mean, there's no way to do that. I don't think there's any way to do this without that. That creates an open source game that they then also publish on Steam. So it's sort of like, you know, you can download this code and compile it yourself and do all these things. I'm betting $20 though.
Yeah, that's literally $20.
You'll just click
the
button in Steam and install it. If you want to go build it yourself, go nuts, man. But I bet what you're going to do is you're going to crack open Steam and you're going to click a button.
That is fascinating. That is no, I don't know. I mean, there's obviously the shareware games of Doom and id Software, which were not open source but are now publicly sourced. The source is public. There was some. What the heck was the game called? There was a game we used to play at university that had like a Lisp engine in it, and it was like some side scroller thing with some really clever lighting effects. And I'm wondering if that was. I know that was we built it from source, but I want to say that it was. No, I don't know if it was published as a payful game. No, that's really interesting. I don't know of anything off the top of my head. No,
because I have to imagine because I even think it's resilient to the idea of like, oh well, then someone's gonna steal my game. It's like, no, they're not going to do that either, right? It's like, if you don't have that core group of devs that know how it all works, I mean, how many times have you seen this where you're just sort of like, there's this code base that these other people wrote, and I have no idea how it works. And you know what? There's probably like only 10 people on the earth that know how it works.
Within our industry, which is famously protective of its intellectual property, I used to make the gag, and I would like to, for any lawyers listening, I never did this. But whenever people were worried about whether or not code or IP was going to leaked out and the effect that it might have, I said, I am 100% confident I could take the lead programmer of a similar desk from like Jump Trading or whomever, HRT, whatever, and invite them over to our current company and sit them down and walk through the code with a whole day, right, in the office, whiteboarding everything, and then at the end present them with a USB thumbstick with the source code on it and wave them goodbye, shake them by the hand, and I'm confident I would set them back 5 years because anything that I gave them is gonna hold them back, right? It's not that the IP is not the code and it's not the approach. In very rare cases, there are little tricks that you're like, oh, that's really unobvious. Okay, I see why that might be a thing. But mostly the IP is a group of people who have worked on a project for a long time together, and this the expanse of the development process and the edge of the envelope of expanding of that kind of like the mm-hmm. frontier of new new stuff comes from those people who are well versed in the system and understanding where the bodies are buried and understanding what things need to go back and be replaced and all of that kind of stuff. None of which you pick up from just being handed, even with like the pointers I gave you, the source code to it, right?
Right.
And that's actually a problem for open source in general.
Yes.
Right. I have this problem with people come and say, "Can I just add this thing to Compiler Explorer?" And I'm like, oh gosh, you know, that means you're gonna have to look at the code, which means that, oh gosh, you're gonna go, no, I don't want to touch this with a barge pole, right?
Yeah, that's the whole thing, is that if this were actually a problem, open source would be so much more effective, right?
Correct.
It would be so much more useful, and people would be able to contribute and all these other things. It doesn't, as you very well know, it doesn't really work that way, right?
Yeah.
Like, you have that sort of core group of people that really understand the system.
And have taken the time and effort to come in and do it. And of course,
exactly.
Hallelujah for those folks who if they're listening. Thank you, everyone.
Yeah. And then you have this whole satellite of other people that are sort of like tourists, essentially, right?
Yeah.
Like, they come in, they might do one or two things, they add a little bit of value here. Sometimes it's like the one thing that really annoys them and they kind of like dig into it or whatever.
Sometimes
it might be.
Thoughtful project maintainers have like tagged issues as like good early first option and they've put enough information to help people in. And then that's kind of like, you know, the sort of the drug dealer or thing of like, come in, make a change. Oh, look at the rush of endorphins you got for fixing a typo in this README.
Yes.
How about this one? Oh, and then before you know it, you're like knee deep in converting things to TypeScript.
Right. The hero's journey backlog, right?
That's right.
Exactly. So I this is why I kind of think it's like you could make a game like this, and is someone gonna fork your code? Well, they're definitely gonna do that. Are they gonna like steal your idea? No. The hard part there is probably getting the Steam thing set up.
Yeah.
And it's like, and honestly, if someone does take it and understand it and makes a whole new game out of it, like, does that really hurt you? Doesn't really
hurt
it's
an interesting
you,
one.
Right.
It's a really interesting observation. I mean, assets are a different
That's
another one that you have to think a little bit about. Like, there isn't really an open source asset system that I'm aware of that is like hackable.
License the assets and the code separately.
That's, I think, probably the. I mean, ultimately, that path leads to stuff like the Unreal Engine, like whatever, where you're like, hey, this is a game engine that makes games of this type. And there's some like basic sprites or whatever, basic 3D models or whatever, to just so that you can type, make, and move your little creature around or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But like, we used it to make this other game. And it's like, you know, that's like, people have been doing that for a while. But open sourcing the whole thing, I don't know if people have done.
I mean, I guess there's things like FreeCiv. That's a thing.
Okay.
But like, I don't think they sell it. I think it is, the model is literally like you download it and compile it. Or maybe you just
Obviously, there are a load of games that have like a plugin architecture that obviously publish enough or people reverse engineer enough to be able to add plugins and modding. So,
I feel like people went crazy with that with like StarCraft. Like, there's so many different StarCraft mods and like different things there. It's like you made.
But I don't know that they published anything there. That was more like people revving it. Whereas like Minecraft, as I call, well, maybe Minecraft being Java was a bit easier to like pull bits out, at least in the beginning. Awesome. I don't know. No, what an interesting idea though. What a fascinating idea. A completely open source.
Yeah. But like a game. Open source, but commercial.
But
and
commercial.
You just, you know, you take the money that you get from selling the game and you use it to pay for the time of the core devs so they can, day jobs, but also sort of, you know.
I was going to say, it sounds like a perfect retirement job for us all,
right?
You know, as we get on in years. You know, give us another 10 years, we might be able to do that. But I don't know what on earth gaming will look like in 10 years' time and whether or not there's any hope for us then. It will be VR.
Yeah.
Or something.
Right. Or AR, maybe.
Or AR, or it'll be written by GPT-4 or 5 or 6 or whatever's around by then.
Uh-huh. Yes, totally.
Cool. Well, what an interesting question. And we've managed to explore some familiar territory along the way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We talked about ASICs. We talked about testing.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about games and our favorite sort of games.
Uh-huh.
And then open sourcing a game. So, I mean, everyone's going to expect the next podcast episode to announce our quitting our day jobs to make some turn-based open world man in a spacesuit game.
Yeah, called Elza.
Yeah.
Right. Cool.
Well, I guess we should call it at that.
That sounds like a good way to end it.
You've been listening to Two's Compliment, a programming podcast by Ben Rady and Matt Godbolt. Find the show transcript and notes at www.twoscompliment.org. Contact us on Mastodon. We are at twoscompliment@hackyderm.io. Our theme music is by Inverse Phase. Find out more at inversephase.com.